free hour. Kick off your shoes, you know, put up your feet and relax. I want to give one word of introduction. Stories are very important. And although it should be obvious, Hasidim did not invent the idea of stories. The Tanakh is full of stories. Because some things can only be learned from life, from experiencing them. But on the other hand, there are certain things that you're not going to be able to experience, and there are certain things that you don't want to experience. Maybe we all have an interest in what it's like to be addicted to drugs, but not firsthand. The way you get the vicarious experience, the secondary experience, is to read a piece of literature that's written well, that you identify with, and you come to experience it, insofar as possible, through the literature. That's more than just being taught the principles. So stories are very important. Stories are slices of life presented in such a way that you can get more out of it than just straight ideas. It touches more of the person than ideas do. So as the sign advertises, I propose to tell you a few stories and then we'll reflect on them and see what their lessons are. Here's one. There was a student of the Maggid. The Maggid of Mizritch was the leader of the Hasidic movement after the Baal Shem Tov died. He was the Baal Shem Tov's main disciple. After Baal Shem Tov died, he took over and he trained rebbes. He had a disciple, the Maggid, who came to him once and said, "I'm just not making any progress. I'm not going anywhere. I'm just stuck. I'm not growing. Not developing." So the Maggid said, "Okay, I'll tell you what you do. There's a certain place in the forest. Get there early in the morning and climb a tree and wait." Okay? So he gets there early in the morning, he climbs a tree, and he waits. And he waits. And he waits. And morning turns to late morning, and late morning turns to noon, and noon turns to afternoon, and he's there in the forest. Mid-afternoon, he hears a tramping, and then out of the forest there appears one of the people from the local village, young man, quite a husky fellow, and he has across his shoulders a pole. And at the end of the two ends of the poles are hanging barrels. He's the water carrier, the local water carrier. And then the disciple up the top of the tree notices that nearby there's a stream. So the water carrier goes over to the stream, looks around, doesn't see anybody because the disciple is up the tree. And he fills the barrels with water. And he puts the pole across his shoulders with the barrels on the ends. And then he jumps across the river, the stream, with the barrels over his shoulders. And then he jumps back across the stream. And he jumps across and back, across and back, across and back, until finally he falls exhausted on the ground, on this side of the stream. Well, the disciple is sure that this is what he was meant to see, but he doesn't get the message. So he climbs down out of the tree, and he goes over to the water carrier and says, "Listen, I'm awfully sorry. I know you thought you were alone, and I was watching you, but my Rebbe sent me here, and he told me that I should climb the tree and wait, and you're the only thing I've seen the whole day, and I'm sure that this is what I was sent to observe, but I don't know what I'm supposed to learn from it. What message is I supposed to give him? Tell me, what were you doing?" So the water carrier said, "Come on, guys. You can do better than this." The water carrier said, "Listen, I'm young, I'm strong, I'm healthy, I carry water for the village, and by mid-afternoon I'm finished, I've given water to all the people, I've earned my money for the day, Now, when I was a child, my parents were poor, and I wasn't sent to school. I find it difficult even to read Hebrew, let alone understand what it means. I can't study Torah. So I thought to myself, what can I do for God? What can I do? And then I realized, the one thing I have is strong muscles. God blessed me with strong muscles. So every afternoon, I finish carrying water for the village. I come out here and I fill up the buckets, the barrels, and I put them across my shoulders. And I dance in honor of God. Jumping across the stream and back is my dancing, and I dance until I drop in honor of God. Aha, said the disciple. Thank you very much. That's the end of the story. What's the lesson here? What's the lesson here?
Turn to the Hebrew.
Yeah, maybe there's another lesson.
Different ways to praise God.
In different ways. And each person has to use what he has. And not look over his shoulder at what somebody else has. The water carrier is not expressing any bitterness that he didn't get an education. He can't read, he can't understand. All he asked himself was, what have I got? What have I got that I can use to serve a God's cause? The Gemara says, Rachmana Libavoy, God desires the heart. A person who serves God wholeheartedly, of course, wholeheartedly means with everything you've got. If you have a brain, use it. But with everything you have, if you serve God wholeheartedly with everything you have, then your service is beloved by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you can have the highest place in heaven. That's all he wants from you. If you're born without certain strengths, without certain abilities, that doesn't handicap you at all. Just look into yourself and find the abilities that you have and use them to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, that's one. Now there's another one, which seems to be similar, but I think it has an addition of another very profound message. This story exists in many different versions. It's the night of Yom Kippur. And, you know, we start Yom Kippur with Kol Nidre. And the Rebbe comes in, and he's sitting there and waiting and waiting and waiting. Usually he's supposed to start it before nightfall. But this year he's waiting and waiting and waiting. A period of time goes by, an hour and a half, till finally he starts Kol Nidre. Very unusual. When it's all over, some of the Hasidim approach the Rebbe and say, you know, that's very unusual. How come you waited so long to say Kol Nidre? The Rebbe said, I was looking above to see if the gates were open so that our prayers could be accepted. And I saw the gates were closed. The gates were totally closed. No, the gates are closed, then you're just squawking. You're not praying. The prayer doesn't go anywhere. There's no point to it. So they said, well, so how did you decide an hour and a half later that it was okay? He said, I'll tell you, a shepherd boy came in to the back of the shul. Nobody noticed him, except I. And he picked up the sitter, and he said to God, you know that I'm a shepherd. And I don't know how to read. So I can't pray to you. I don't know how to pray to you. But I do know the alphabet. I know the names of the letters. So here's what I'll do. I'll say the letters. And you, God, take the letters and make them into words of prayer. You make the words. I'll just give you the letters. And when he said the letters, God made them into prayers and not opened the gates. And then we could pray also. This story exists in many versions. A common Hasidic theme. So, of course, it sounds a lot like the previous story. Rachmana Libavoy, God wants the heart. with God wants heart. And this boy prayed with all his heart, and that's what opened the gates. And it means that we depended upon him. All the smarter people, all the better educated people, their prayers couldn't go up until the shepherd boy opened the gates. Why? Why do you think? Why was he the only one that could open the gates? Is it an advantage to be ignorant, unlettered? I wouldn't think so, not in our tradition. So how come the gates wouldn't open for anybody else, not even the Rebbe's prayer? Only for the shepherd boy. So you could say, I mean, these stories don't come with commentaries, you know. You could say, his quality of heart was outstanding. And what was needed to open the gates was the quality of heart and the education of the others. Right? But they didn't have the same quality of heart. You could say that. I think there's some truth to that. But I think that there's another deep point here that we should all reflect on. How do we look at the shepherd boy? Ah, well, he's illiterate. Could you imagine? He's illiterate. He can't even read Hebrew words, let alone understand them. Me? I'm not like that. No, I can read. I can understand. I've studied. I have complicated ideas in my head. You know, I have understanding. He's illiterate. But me, I'm somebody special. You know, I really have something. But who are we praying to? We're praying to an infinite creator. Now let's measure. Let's measure one against infinity, and 100 against infinity, and 1,000 against infinity, and 1,000,000 against infinity. They're all zero. They're all zero. Any number is zero against infinity. So if I'm looking down at the shepherd boy, I think of myself as very great. But if I look up, and look up together with the shepherd boy, I realize that from the point of view of the infinite creator, there's no difference between the shepherd boy. The difference is an illusion. Because vis-a-vis infinity, if I'm 1,000,000 and he's 1, vis-a-vis infinity, we're both 0. And that means that our sophisticated prayers vis-a-vis God are nothing but reciting letters. Or you could call it the squawking of chickens. It doesn't matter. It has no intrinsic value. That means the only value comes from the heart. Now, don't make the mistake, and I will say it explicitly, don't make the Christian mistake. Don't make the Christian mistake of thinking that if everything that counts is the heart, then the brain doesn't count. No! If the heart is there, then the brain will be there, because the heart wants to serve God with all of what you are. The heart doesn't negate the brain. The heart doesn't take precedence over the brain. The heart isn't better than the brain. The heart feeds the whole body. The heart keeps the whole body alive. The heart sends blood to the brain and keeps the brain functioning. So the heart organizes and galvanizes and motivates all of the parts of the person to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And they all have to be there. And they were all created to be there. And they're all trustworthy and reliable to be there. But without the heart, you have nothing. One way to see that is to remember that, in essence, we are all shepherd boys in that respect. You with me? Okay. Now, I want to tell you a few stories with an entirely different message, a sort of quasi-political message. They all have the same theme, but they all express it in a slightly different way. The Rebbe of Schmelk of Nikolsburg, famous Hasidic Rebbe, living in a town where there was considerable opposition to the Hasidic movement. And there are a number of stories of how he had to deal with the opposition. He had a custom. Erev Yom Kippur, it's a mitzvah to eat. eat and drink. Indeed, according to some anyway, it's the only, that and matzah are the only biblical mitzvahs to eat that we have left. When the temple was standing, there were many such mitzvahs, but today there are only two. Matzah on Pesach and the day before Yom Kippur. So, many used to eat and drink all day, except for the other mitzvahs that preclude them eating and drink all day. Instead of going to Vilna, you used to have a candy that's not the whole day. Instead of ingesting something the whole day. He had a principle that whenever someone brought him something to eat and or drink, he would eat it or drink it. Now, there was one of the opponents of Hasidus in the town who said, I'm going to get him. He bought up a store of liquor, good liquor, and he came on Erev Yom Kippur, and as Rebbe Shmuelka was sitting at the table, he put down a bottle of liquor, and Rebbe Shmuelka drank from it, and put down another bottle. His plan was to get the Rebbe drunk on Erev Yom Kippur, and then he'll make a disgrace of himself, and then everybody will see what he's going to see tomorrow. You know, they're just phony jokers, you know, no substance to them. So that's the idea. He kept putting down bottle after bottle, and the Rebbe kept drinking out of all of the bottles. Some of the bottles were passing around. But it didn't seem to show any effect. He just kept going. So the Snagit thought, but, you know, some people react to have a delayed reaction, you know. So he stuck around. Kate said to David, called Nidre, the 3 hours of davening, seemed to be clear and enthusiastic, exalted. When the davening is over, the custom is to say the Book of Psalms. And they're going along, saying the Book of Psalms, and they're just saying it out loud, you know, and the Messiah is waiting, hoping, waiting for something to happen. Comes to the 41st Psalm. And in there's a verse. Bezos yadati ki chofatzti kilo yuria oivi olai. The Rebbe came to that verse, and he said it, and then he repeated it, and then he repeated it, and then he repeated it, and he repeated it, and the Misnagit thought, finally, he's gone blink. You know, he's gone off his crackers. He's losing it, and he kept repeating it and repeating it, and then finally he stopped. And he said, I want to teach you what this verse means. Now, if you look at your helpful, friendly, ethical Talmud, they'll probably translate it something like this. With this I know that you had a pleasure in me. My enemy does not trumpet over me. Yoriya from Lahariya, true. This is how I know, God, that you have pleasure in me. That my enemy did not trumpet over me, which means he didn't triumph over me, didn't win over me. But the Rebbe Shmuelka said, I want to explain it differently. With this I know, God, that you had pleasure in me, that my enemy did not come to evil through me. Yeriah, from the word ra. He didn't come to evil through me. This is how I know you have pleasure in me. Not to say to the Misnagid, you tried to get me drunk, you criminal. But look, God protected me. He protected me from you. You're going to hell. But I'm protected and I'm going to heaven. That's not what he said. What he said was, how do I know you have pleasure in me? That you didn't make me the instrument by which the Misnagid should get hurt. That he shouldn't come to evil through me. From which the Misnagid saw that even though the Misnagid was trying to destroy him, all the Rebbe cared about was saving him. Of course, that won him over, changed his attitude towards what was going on. There's another similar story, but I mean similar in message, but quite different in presentation. There was a rav in a certain town, and a couple, husband and wife, were traveling through the town. Traveling through. While they were there, they had a problem, and they went to the rav for a decision. And the Rav gave them a decision. It was what we call a shalas noshim, whether they're permitted to have relations with one another because of the blood that she saw. And he said, yes, you are permitted. And then they left. Several hours later, towards evening, the Rav thought over again what he told them and began to have doubts. Maybe I made a mistake. Now, you know, if you make a mistake under those conditions, you cannot call their cell phone. And you can't send them a fax or an email. They're gone! They're hours away from town. You'll never catch up with them. It's evening already. But if he's wrong, then they're going to do something, and it's desperately wrong, tragically wrong. And he's torturing himself. How could I have made such a mistake? Usually someone who serves the Jewish people in this way has a certain protection from heaven that he shouldn't make mistakes like this. And here, that protection let him down. So that means these things. Something must be wrong with me, and I must be failing in some way. What could I have done wrong that I should be punished in such a terrible way? And then it hits him. He had heard earlier that the Baal Shem Tov had come to town that day, and he says to himself, I didn't do anything about it. That faker, that you know, rabble-rouser came to town, and it's my town, and I'm the rover of the town, and I didn't do anything about it. That's my failure. This is why I'm being punished. By now it's already 11:30 at night. And he's distraught. And he realizes in his mind what he's done wrong. And he knows where the Baal Shem Tov is staying. So in a trance, he picks himself up and starts going to where the Baal Shem Tov is. And on the way he picks up some stones. He's going to do something. Well, he arrives at the house and the Baal Shem Tov is outside waiting for him. And the Baal Shem Tov explains to him that he did not make a mistake in his decision. The decision was, in fact, correct. Oh, he's so thankful, so relieved. And the Baal Shem Tov is the one who's explaining to him why it was a correct decision. So he thanks the Baal Shem Tov immensely, and then he's walking home. And as he's walking home, remember the stones that he picked up? As he's walking home, he's tossing the stones over his shoulder. You know, in a kind of carefree, happy mood. After a while, he hears footsteps behind him. It's 12:30 at night. Turns around, and he sees the Baal Shem Tov coming after him. And he notices that the Baal Shem Tov has been picking up the stones that he, the Rav, is throwing over his shoulder. So he says to the Baal Shem Tov, why are you picking up the stones? And the Baal Shem Tov says, stones that were gathered l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, should not roll in the dirt. That's what I said when I heard this. Stones that were gathered l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, should not roll in the dirt. You understand? The Rav picked up the stones to throw them at the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov says, you picked them up with holy intentions. You picked them up for the sake of heaven. To throw them at me! You picked them up for the sake of heaven, and you shouldn't roll them in the dirt. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary story. The Chassid movement inherently is a much more liberal movement. The opponents are titled opponents. Misnagdim. Misnagdim means you're against. Chassidim aren't against. They aren't against. They tell a joke. The Mashiach will have to be Misnagdim. The Mashiach cannot be a Chassid. He has to be Misnagdim. Because if he'll be a Chassid, the Misnagdim won't accept him. Whereas if he's a Misnagdim, then the Chassidim will accept him. Because it will accept it. If it's a chassid, it's not going to accept this. It can't be. But we're, you know, that's the sense of openness. Sense of openness that there is in the Hasidic movement. Not to be against, not to be exclusive. And to recognize even though the Shem Shemayim, the to do something for the sake of heaven, that there could be in a group of people who oppose it. Then there's a story that has a kind of bridging. Now, this story exists in many versions, and I heard it in one version, I recently heard it in another version. I'll tell you the version I heard first. A man's father passed away, and they had a funeral and burial. And after that, the son started having dreams. And in the dreams, the father came to him and said, "You have to convert to Christianity." But this was very disturbing. This was very disturbing to the son. But it happened night after night. It's like it was driving him crazy. What to do about that? Now, the way I heard it, the man went to the Gaon of Vilna, and he said, "Dig up your father's coffin, and you'll find that the grave diggers in those days were Christians. One of the grave diggers must have had a cross around his neck, and he didn't know, but it fell into the grave. And if you'll dig it up and find the cross, take it out, then rebury it, you'll find that the dreams will go away." So they dug up the coffin, and indeed they did find the cross there. They took the cross out, and the dreams went away. Fine. Now, as you know, the Gaon of Vilna was very opposed to the Hasidic movement, and he thought about this incident. This idea that the Gaon of Vilna used is based on a Yerushalmi in Zeroyim someplace. A very obscure place, a place that only the top scholars would know. The Gaon of Vilna thought, "I'll make this into an example." He said to the guy, "Listen, I want you to go to such and such a town. In there, there's a Hasidic Rebbe. I want you to put this problem to him and see what he says. See what kind of answer you get." So the man goes to the town, he goes to the Rebbe, he says, "Listen, I buried my father, and it's coming to me in a dream, I converted to Christianity, what should I do?" So the Rebbe said, "Give me 3 days, and come back, and I hope I'll be able to tell you what to do." So that's 3 days go by, and he goes back, and the Rebbe says, "Go dig up your father's grave, and you'll find that there's a cross there, and if you take the cross out, the fumes will stop." Fine! So the man goes back to the Gaon of Vilna, and he says, "He told me the same thing you did. Look at that. So you told me, that's what he told me." So Gaon says, "I don't believe it. It can't be. It's impossible that he should know that you're a Shalmi in Svarim over there. It's just inconceivable. Go back and ask him how he knows it." So he goes back to the Rebbe and he says, "Listen, I'm being sent by the Gaon of Vilna," and he says it's a place in Yerushalmi, and he wants to know how you knew it. So the Rebbe starts to cry. And he says, "Oh, I think it was Rebbe Zusha, actually. He says, Zusha, if only you would be learned, then you could save your body from fasting." He said, "Go back and tell the Gaon of Vilna that I had it from the same place that Yerushalmi had it." Where did the Yerushalmi get it? Ultimately, he got it from God. "I got it from there." In other words, "I got it by fasting 3 days. The Rosh Rofa gave me the answer. True, I didn't know. I didn't know that Yerushalmi. But I had it from where the Yerushalmi had it." And then he came back and told the Gaon of Vilna. And the Gaon of Vilna made some remark about what it means to be a tzaddik. Anyway, and here you see again the idea, that's like a Hasidic story, right? To the idea of appreciation for both sides. Not appreciation for both sides. Okay? You with me? Okay. Now I'm going to take an entirely different story, and this will have a slightly different and deeper moral in a way, and then maybe we'll finish with that. They tell this story about the Maggid or about the Belzer Rebbe. It's told about a number of different Rebbes. A man needed to marry off his daughter. It's a fantastic sum of money, and he was not a wealthy man. So he went to the Rebbe and asked him what to do. And the Rebbe said, "I'll tell you. I'll give you 2 rubles, and I give you a blessing that you take the first business deal that is offered, and I give you a blessing that it should be successful. Fine, takes the 2 rubles, and he's going home. It was a many-day journey. At the end of the first day, he comes to an inn. Inns in those days were often owned by Jews. From Jews, he could get a kosher meal, a place to sleep, a reasonably healthy environment, rather than the Gracia inns, where he could get beaten up or killed or robbed. So he comes in, sits down, he orders his dinner, and then he sitting there saying psalms or studying. The innkeeper ran a kosher inn, but he wasn't very pious. He wasn't very elevated in his Torah observance. He was sitting there with 2 of his friends playing cards. And after a while, the innkeeper says, "You see that guy over there, that chassid? Do you know what these chassidim are like? They are so silly, simplistic, foolish, naive. You watch, I'm going to have some fun with you." So he goes over to the chassid and he says, "Yid, I have something to sell. Something unique. Something that no one else has. Something that's absolutely the only thing like it in the world. Are you interested in buying it?" The chassid thinks, "Wow, I already gave me a bracha, a blessing that I should take the first business deal. I didn't even get home yet. And here's a guy offering me a business deal. This sounds terrific." He says, "Sure, tell me what are you offering for sale?" And the innkeeper says, "I'm willing to sell you my share in the world to come. How much money do you have?" So Chassid says, "I have 2 rubles. "That's it? For you special. Just for you on a one-time sale basis. My share in the world to come for 2 rubles. So the Chassid thinks, "His share in the world to come? Is that the sort of thing that's, you know, on the stock exchange? You know, it's an overcounted stock? What kind of thing is this? On the other hand, he's offering me a business deal. And my rabbi said to take the first deal." So he says, "Okay." So the innkeeper laughs. He says, "Okay, hand over the 2 rubles. And the Chassid says, "Just a moment. I want to start. I want a document." So the innkeeper goes to his 2 friends, and they serve as the 2 witnesses, and he writes out a document. "I, so-and-so, hereby sign over my share in the world to come. So-and-so, 2 witnesses sign it." Then Chassid reads it, and the star is good. And he hands over his 2 rubles, and the innkeeper gives him the star, and then the Chassid goes up to sleep. And the innkeeper thinks that this is a big joke. Look at this, he made 2 rubles for a piece of paper, right? For a worthless piece of paper. And they chuckle about it, and after that, the 2 friends go home, and he goes up to go to bed. Comes into to the bedroom, where his wife is, and he says to her, "Boy, did you miss something downstairs. You should have heard it. Look, listen to this joke. And we made 2 rubles for nothing." He tells her the whole story, and then he notices that she is not laughing. And he says to her, "What's the matter with you? Isn't this funny? These people are so stupid, and I made 2 rubles for nothing." She says to him, "Listen, you know, we weren't all that super frum, but I do remember in the winter afternoons, my father, Shabbos afternoons, used to read Pirkei Avos. And Pirkei Avos starts with the words, 'Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek olam haba.' Every Jew has a share in the world to come." No. So if every Jew has a share in the world to come, and you lost your share of the world to come, it follows that you're not Jewish. She says to her, "You know what? You're cracked. You're cracked. What do you mean I'm not Jewish? I had a bris meal, I had a bar mitzvah, you know, we got married under a chuppah. What are you talking about? Listen. This is Aristotle talking. Listen. Every Jew has a share of the world to come, and you don't have a share of the world to come. So, by syllogistic logic, it follows that you're not Jewish, period. And you can't shake her. You cannot shake her." So, after an hour's fruitless wrangling, he says to her, "Well, goodness gracious, what are we going to do about it?" And she says, "I guess if he was willing to buy your share in the world to come, he might be willing to sell it back." And so it was at 2:30 a.m. that they tramped up to the chassid's room and they bang on his door. And he comes to the door. Yes, what do you want? The innkeeper says, listen, you remember that little transaction that we had downstairs a few hours ago? Yes. And I sold him a share in the world to come. Well, I want to buy it back. And you know what? For your trouble, I'll give you 4 rubles. Now that's 100% profit. And you didn't do anything to deserve it. Just give me the piece of paper. I'll give you the 4 rubles and we'll call it square. And the chassid says, well, just a moment. And the innkeeper says, you want more money? 6 rubles, 8 rubles, 10 rubles. Just give me the piece of paper. And the chassid says, just a moment, just a moment. Why do you think I went through with that somewhat questionable deal downstairs hours ago? Because my Rebbe told me to take the first business deal that came along. He told me about buying. He didn't tell me anything about selling. So the innkeeper turns to his wife and he says, I told you, the guy is really from the moon. He bought it for 2. I wanted to give him 10. And he's saying, no, what do we do now? And the wife says, I guess we go to the Rebbe. And so it was the next morning. Then they hitched up the horses to the wagon, to the carriage. This time the chassid goes back in a carriage, not walking this time. And they drive to the Rebbe. And they go in, and the innkeeper tells the Rebbe the whole story. And the Rebbe says to the innkeeper, you are a fool. I'm not going to comment now on the value of your share in the world to come. But to trifle with it, to sell it, you're a fool. But I think that I could convince my chassid to buy it back for 400 rubles. At which point the innkeeper is 400. Bang, he's down, out. He's feet of dead away. That's the money that the chassid needs to marry off his daughter. But what can he do? That's what the Rebbe says. That's what the wife says. That's what the chassid says. So the innkeeper says, okay, I'll find a way and I'll get the 400 rubles. And they're all ready to go. At the last minute, the wife says, I have to go back and ask the Rebbe a question. She says, listen, you're right. My husband is a fool. Correct. But I have to know, is his share of the world to come worth 400 rubles? What we're paying for it? Is it really worth it? And the Rebbe said, when he sold it for 2, it wasn't worth even that. And now that he's willing to pay 400 for it, its value cannot be measured in money. That's the end of the story. Okay, so on a simple level, you know, a person is a Jew, and it's being a Jew, it should be the most important thing to him. But there's a deeper lesson here, at least one. Olam Haba is not just something that will happen someday. Olam Haba is an idea that puts a stamp on your life even now. What am I living for? What's really meaningful? What really counts? What's really valuable? You can sort of define a person by his attitude towards this world, and his attitude towards this world depends a great deal on whether he thinks this world is everything or this world is just the entranceway to something else. If a person thinks this world is everything, you get the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. What difference does it make? In the long run, everything comes to death, so what difference does it make how I live? People who go after pleasures, or people who dedicate themselves just to making this world a better place, rather than thinking about how they can transcend this world. Olam Haba, the world to come, changes a person's attitude towards this world. This world is a world of preparation. It's a world of planting, not a world of reaping. Yes, there's some minor payoff here, but it's really a world of creativity, not sitting back to enjoy what you've created. So if you use Olam Haba as brackets around this world, then you get a realistic appreciation of what this world is. This world is only a preparation and an entranceway to something else. Then you know how to evaluate it. rather than missing out on the true importance or value of things. I don't know how many of you play musical instruments, but when I was serious about music, when I was about your age, and I played a lot, I divided every practice session in half. One half was exercises, and one half was the pieces that I was trying to master. Exercises are boring! Especially love music. They're boring! I would much rather have spent the whole time playing music. But the exercises are the investment. And playing music is reaping the investment. And if you get to a certain level and all you do is play music, then you will never play harder music. You'll never play more complicated music. So you'll be reaping the whole time, but you'll be reaping much less than you could have achieved had you made more investment. Realizing that this world is a world of preparation gives you the focus and the strength to invest. And that's where you do prepare yourself ultimately to reap the greatest benefit that can be reaped. So you use Olam HaBo as an idea that orients you to Olam HaZeh. And if you do that, then your attitude towards Olam HaZeh is appropriate, and your use of Olam HaZeh can be appropriate. Don't sell your Olam HaBo for 2 rubles that you could make your Olam HaZeh. Follow me? Questions? Yeah.
Just a general question on these stories. And I hear a lot that you hear some of these specific stories, and a lot of them very hard to understand. A lot of them don't fall from the nature and all this stuff. And a lot of people say you shouldn't believe all you hear. But what do you say to that?
I'll tell you what the Satmar Rebbe of 3 generations ago said in Europe. He said, anybody who believes all the Hasidic stories is a fool. It's a Hasidic Rebbe talking. Anybody who believes all the Hasidic stories is a fool. And anyone who thinks that any of them could not have happened is a heretic.
Isn't that tomorrow going to God at all?
Chas v'shalom. Chas v'shalom. Gemara? You have to believe. No. Chas v'shalom. Gemara, you have to believe everything, but you have to know what it says. Some of the things in the Gemara are mashal. They're just analogies. They're not meant to be literal. But yeah, it's true. Maybe this is what you heard. The Rambam writes in his introduction to. Very Chelik, I think, that anybody who believes all of the Haggadic portions of the Talmud as if they were literal, he takes them as if they were literal and believes that they're true, is a fool. He's crazy, in fact. He says, Rambam over there says, people's attitude towards Haggadic divides into 3 groups. There's a group that takes them all literally and believes them all, and you're proud of believing them all. But yeah, this is really crazy. This is really crazy. So when I believe it, that proves how much I love God and how pious I am, because I'm believing really crazy things. That's a very Christian attitude. The crazier it is, the stronger I believe it, to prove how dedicated I am to God. And Rambam says, you guys are crazy. Worse than they, he says, worse than they, are the people who say, these things are crazy, so they're wrong. They're just wrong. They're worse, he says, because the sages of the Talmud in the revealed parts showed that they are great geniuses, that they have a passion for truth, and this guy said he could judge better than them and say, yeah, over here they just made mistakes and they said stupid things, you know. They're worse than the first group. And then he says the third group, and he says, Chai Hashem, by the life of God, or the living God, this group is so small, he says, you shouldn't even call it a group. He says, it's sort of like what we call a singleton, a class of one member. If it's a class of one member, then it's really the one member, it's not a class. He says, this group is so small, so you should think of it like a singleton, he says. This group says, if the thing in its literal meaning is crazy, and very great scholars said it, the thing to conclude is that it has another meaning. and then to say, honestly, I don't know the other thing. So it's my ignorance. And that's the attitude that one ought to take. But not to say I don't believe it. Not to say I don't believe it. I believe it. It's just I have to analyze what it is, what it means.
Wait, the last, what you just said is the symbolism?
Yes. The last, that's the correct.
That's what you believe.
Who's he?
The Rama.
Yes, yes.
Don't have a
computer
for
that. For sure.
For that? But I'm like, what he says on Agathis.
Maybe a particular Agathis, but not this attitude towards Agathis. This attitude towards Agathis, everybody believes it. If the thing sounds impossible, then probably it has another meaning, and you should work to figure out what the other meaning is, and if you don't figure it out, confess your ignorance and say, I don't know what they meant. No one contradicts him in that attitude. When he applied that attitude to particular Agathis, others may say, no, that's a mistake. You didn't get that Agathis right. So everybody agrees that some Agathis have to be taken that way. For sure. You have to understand, Chazal, when they used language, they didn't use language the way we use language. It's like any corpus of literature. This has nothing to do with religion now. Even corpus of literature has its own way of speaking. For example, Chazal say many times, X, Y, Z were created before the creation of the world. No. They were created before the creation of the world, whatever they are. Now, what does that mean? We know very well that time is part of the created world. So, the first group person says, doesn't matter, there's time before time. You see, it sounds very paradoxical, but that's great. I love paradoxes, you know. It shows how firm I am. I believe even in paradoxes. There is no time, and there is time, and they're both true, and then, you know, and they're both true and both false, and it's all true at the same time, and now we can go and eat pizza. Right? That's a nut. And the other person says, if time is created, there can't be a time before the universe. And Mimele and Chazal contradicted themselves. They didn't know what they're talking about. They made a mistake. Right? Those are the both wrong attitudes. The right attitude is, obviously, before here doesn't mean time. And I don't know what it means. And therefore, I don't really know what they're talking about. And I tell you now, speaking for myself, I do know what it means. Often it means logical priority. It means these are things upon which the world depends. And if these things didn't exist, the world would have no purpose, no function, and no ability to survive. So before means they're logically prior to the world that we live in, not temporally prior. They said before because they weren't giving logic lessons. Right? That's the idea. Everybody agrees on that methodology. No, that's not unique to the Rambam.